Hi, welcome back to Capiche SaaS Radio Hour. Today I've got a special guest joining us from Vanta. Christina, thank you so much for taking the time to come on the call today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited.
So I think I first heard about Vanta, this must have been several months ago now, maybe earlier this year. There was a discussion on the Capiche community basically about should software have a God mode of sorts where SaaS support employees can go in there and basically jump into your account, edit settings, and tweak stuff. And I remember someone had come into the discussion there and mentioned Vanta's privacy and security screening tools. And that, I believe, is the first time I'd heard of your team. So could you tell us real quick, just what is Vanta? What are you building here?
For other technology startups, other software businesses, where we help a startup get secure. So put in good security practices, kind of, and then help them prove that security. So it sounds like, actually not in this case, but often a lot of SaaS companies, as they're selling their products, will get asked to go through security review or have compliance certifications or SOC 2. So we help companies get those faster and more efficiently too. So Vanta does these two things, helping companies get secure and then prove their security.
Nice. So SOC 2 is how you just pronounced that. I was saying SOT2 before. SOC 2, could you tell us a bit about that? What, for listeners who have never gone through SOC 2 certification, what does that include?
Yeah, for sure. So start again, kind of high level. So SOC 2 is a sort of security standard made by the AICTA, the American Institute of CPAs. And really high level, it's a way to get an audit. So have the auditor come in and check out your security practices and say that, you know, hey, you know, they look good. I was really rigorous. I was really thorough. I looked at everything this company does. And I trust them. And so you, prospect or customer, you should trust them and their security practices too. And so that's kind of what a SOC 2 is and what it serves. It's sort of like a, again, like, I don't know if you remember applying to college, applied to college in the last, like, I don't know, 15 years or so in like a common application, right? It's like, it's sort of like the common application for security review. So it's like, okay, fill out this one thing, have someone, again, rigorously go through it. And if they accept it, then hopefully all your prospects and customers will also accept it. And so not ask you to go through their security review or answer things one-off, that sort of thing.
Right, gotcha. And is this generally a globally accepted standard, or is this mainly aimed at U.S.-based companies?
Interesting. So it is, as the American Institute of CPAs, who does it, so it's an American standard.
Yep.
And it's the standard that American companies prefer. So it tends to be what you need if you're selling to American companies. So if you're a German company selling to Americans, you actually probably will be asked to go through a SOC 2 audit.
Right, makes sense. Is there an ISO standard that's similar? I believe I had seen something, but I'm not remembering.
Oh, yeah, you know the stuff. Yeah, so there is. So there's so ISO, kind of big global standards body. They literally write standards for pretty much everything under the sun.
Right.
And ISO 27001 and 2702. How you say these, but actually 27001 and 27002. Those standards are sort of the closest equivalent to SOC 2.
Gotcha, interesting. And if a company goes through SOC 2, would they potentially still need to go through ISO, that'd be 27001, certification as well?
Potentially, so it really depends, our advice is it really depends on who you're selling to. So again, best guide is go ask your prospects and go ask your customers what they want. Generally, what we see is American companies strongly prefer a SOC 2, and European companies will often take either. They might prefer an ISO standard, but because they have so many American software vendors, will often accept either.
Right. Gotcha. That makes sense. So Vanta itself, what gave you the idea of taking this on as a problem of helping companies pass their SOC 2 certification?
For sure. So prior to Vanta, I was a product manager at Dropbox. And I worked on Dropbox Paper, which is a new product for
Netflix.
And kind of a longer story here, but the shorter version is in trying to bring Paper to market and even give it away to Dropbox's customers, actually kind of got blocked by doing that because Dropbox had made commitments to its customers saying, hey, we're SOC 2 certified, we're secure, we're pen tested, you know, here's all of our security practices at Dropbox. And we were, you know, a part of Dropbox that kind of couldn't make those claims. And so we actually couldn't even really take the product to market without going through and doing this. Right? Which is, I mean, honestly quite frustrating. And so we as a, I think we were like a 7 or 8 person team at that point, sort of had this terrible decision to make, which was either put all the product development on hold and, you know, at the time we didn't feel like we had product market fit, but just, you know, pause that for a year and do all this security and compliance work. So that then we could go test for product market fit with these customers. So it's kind of option A.
Right.
And which didn't feel very good. And then option B was, okay, don't do all the security and compliance stuff, but then you can't even, you know, you can't have users who have Dropbox contracts. And, you know, now Dropbox is public until these numbers are public, but, you know, whatever, 60 million Dropbox customers. And they tend to be early adopters, and they tend to be the ones interested in new tools. And anyway, that was sort of the decision we had as a product team. And we weren't option B. And, you know, forewent the security and compliance work, which was, you know, it's hard to kind of quarterback the decision now, but was definitely also had its own challenges in finding product market fit, for sure.
Yeah. Interesting. It's harder for a large company to ship a product or ship something new than it would be for a startup, where startups can basically take the move fast and break things mentality, and existing customers have to be much more conservative, I guess, with how they would roll out new products.
Yeah, and I think it just really comes back to the commitment that the startup or company has made its customers, right? And so like just as you kind of grow and succeed and persist as a company, you're going to make more commitments over time. And so you've got to, you know, continue to uphold them. I think that kind of explains a lot of the tension you're describing there. You know, one of the things that also kind of a founding thesis of Vanta almost was that a security review and ensuring the security of software is just fundamentally a really, really important thing. And for lots of reasons, you know, good and bad, culturally, we sort of trust software and we trust technology companies less, you know, in 2020 than we did in 2018, than we did 5, 10 years ago. Right. And that's sort of a one-way ratchet. Like, it's hard to imagine going back to, I don't know, 2010, where it's like, oh, you made a new Facebook app? That's so great. I'll install it. And I'm so excited. Right. Like, now it's sort of like, who are you? What are you going to do with my, like, how many people are you going to leak this to? And so that, like, fundamentally, we just trust software less, but it's kind of becoming more and more a part of our lives. And that in that sort of tension is going to step things like security review. It's going to step things like how can you prove or demonstrate the security of your software. And so as part of that, more and more startups will kind of be faced with these audits and kind of, I don't know, paying this tax. And so what used to just be an enterprise problem or just be a, you know, big company problem is going to increasingly be a everyone problem. And so, you know, what sort of tools can be built to sort of level the playing field and help these kind of innovative startups compete?
Interesting. So back to Dropbox Paper, I'm curious, was there something specific to the product that would make it more difficult for something like Dropbox Paper to pass SOC 2 certification versus the standard Dropbox product? Or is it just in the process of building something fast, you hadn't had time to go through the certification?
Yeah, much more the latter. So it tends to be less about what the product is or does and more about how it's built, so it's kind of infrastructure pieces. What sort of, I don't know how technical we want to get into here, but like, you know, kind of how the cloud infrastructure, the AWS account is set up, who has access to change code, what code, who has access to customer data. It tends to be things like that more than...
Okay.
What sort of data is stored in some ways.
So then if you're building a new SaaS product today, if you're listening and you're considering building a new app, what steps should a startup take to sort of ensure that they're building with privacy and security in mind from the start, from things
that
your team has seen?
Yeah, so a few things, and we're actually just kind of debriefing on some of this today too. So a really big thing with these, well, actually maybe step one, if you're just starting to build, following kind of good engineering and good security engineering practices will get you 75 to 80% of the way there. So I think sometimes it sort of seems like there's, you know, security stuff to do, and then there's compliance stuff to do, and these are kind of totally adjacent spheres and there's no overlap. I think if you do these compliance audits well, actually doing them well means sort of forcing a lot of overlap there. So doing real security things that, you know, are technically meaningful and are impactful, and using those for the compliance audit, right? Cause kind of having, yeah,
right.
having those divorced is unlikely to produce good security one way or the other, and it's kind of the ultimate North Star goal here. So that is like one guiding principle. A few specifics. So generally something that is helpful both from a, you know, security perspective, security workflow, and also compliance perspective is accountability. So this, and this actually gets into one of the things you opened with God mode, but accountability means here seeing or being able to track like who had access to or changed what at sort of what time. And this ends up being helpful, not really in the moment, right? Like, you know, Christina looked at this, you know, page at this timestamp. Like, again, no one really wants to, you know, real-time feed of that. That's super helpful. But if something, you know, kind of God forbid something were to happen or there's some breach, having these logs is sort of invaluable. Because if your record of like, well, if there was somebody who was unknown, potentially malicious, like what did they have access to? And if you're sort of writing everything down that happens, you have your answer right there. Whereas if you don't have that, you sort of have to assume the worst. And the worst is, you know, again, we've leaked all the data we have, which is really just an email no one ever wants to write to anyone ever.
Right. Interesting. So then basically one of the biggest things here then is keeping more or less audit logs where you can see, it's not that you can't have a God mode or you shouldn't have a way where a customer support team can go access a customer's account and change stuff, but it's that you need an audit log and tracking of who had permission to go in, who did it, and then if something goes wrong, then you can go back and figure out, okay, what happened?
Absolutely, yeah. That's one of the really big things. There's another piece here of in the security and compliance world, it's called access requests or access logs, but basically having also some record of, you know, hey, we onboarded a new employee, Sally. Like, Sally is going to have access to God mode. She can do that because Christina said she could. Great. Okay, now Sally has access. Wonderful. You know, and then, you know, sometime later, like, Sally's decided to move on from the company. We're going to remove Sally's access, you know, as soon as she's no longer with the company, so we don't have this dangling, you know, account that has access to God.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Right. So like kind of things like that, and having, I mean, I want to say lightweight, but like processes appropriate to your, you know, stage and size of company. And so if you're just a few people, I mean, you know, super lightweight processes here, but just something so you kind of, again, understand who or which accounts have access to what, and make that circle as, you know, tight as possible or feasible for business reasons. So that's not to say, you know, cut everybody off except for one employee from customer data at all. It's just kind of be judicious and be thoughtful about who does have access to that data and is there a, you know, kind of business reason for them to do so. And if so, great, you know, give them access and be responsible about it. But if it's not a business reason, like, it's probably best not to.
That brings up an interesting point that a large part of this is not just the security of your specific application, but also of all the software in your stack that your team is using to sort of run your company. And that puts a lot on, I guess, the onboarding and offboarding process and perhaps tools like Okta that can roll up accounts for new users and then make sure that they're deleted and cleared out when they leave the company.
Yeah, absolutely. We see folks use you know, I think really the progression we've seen is everyone, people kind of don't track this, you know, sort of at all. And then they start tracking it in, you know, spreadsheet or something, right? And they have checklists.
Yep.
And then, you know, they sound familiar, sound like you've done this before. And then at some point, either when, you know, there's just enough flying around or someone comes in and who's like, hey, I used Okta at my last job. And like, I am not going to put up with your spreadsheet. I'm just going to buy Okta and I'm going to make my life easier. But yeah, eventually transitioning to some sort of kind of centralized as possible identity access management tool to make some of this easier.
Awesome. If you're listening right now, don't forget you can send in a message if you have any questions for Christina or the Vanta team about security and compliance. If you're listening online, there's a message box on the bottom of the page. You can send in a message and we'll ask it live on the show here in a few minutes. So, Christina, I'm curious, what do you think the future looks like here? It seems like there's an increasing amount of legislation. Of course, in the EU, you have GDPR with customer data and the sort of right to be forgotten, I believe, or right to be deleted. I forget what they exactly call it, but where companies have to be able to remove all of the customer's data from their servers. And then in the U.S., I believe California has been talking about more privacy laws. Where do you see this landscape shifting, I guess, from almost a government perspective and regulation perspective?
Yeah, it is really interesting, I think. And there's you know, government initiatives here, like ones in the EU and California and Brazil that you mentioned. And then there's also these, they're really just professional associations. So the AICPA is actually literally accountants. You know, PCI is a consortium of credit card companies. But these sort of kind of de facto professional associations that have put together standards. And I think I mentioned the one-way ratchet comment earlier. I think in the future, we can just expect more regulation. And whether it is actually government regulation or, again, it's sort of de facto regulation from industry standards and norms, it's just really hard to imagine going back to that world of, again, you know, 2008, I don't know what it was, maybe 2000 to 2008, you know, software building where it was, you know, I'm so excited about the new thing you built that I will, you know, basically give you my bank account information because what's the worst that could happen? right? And we sort of, you know, played that one out and we're like, oh, Equifax, yeah, that was pretty bad, right? Like the worst that can happen,
yeah,
which is kind of unpleasant here. And so I think there will just be more scrutiny around software vendors. And this is both for, you know, people who build software and, again, it's for what they're building, and to your point earlier also, the software they're using, so their sort of software supply chain, as it's known. And we just expect more scrutiny here. I also think, and again, kind of, I mean, I'm a little biased because of Vanta, but I sort of chose to be biased, or sort of why we started Vanta is a lot of these audits and standards in general are sort of built. They're built for software, but they're not built with sort of modern software development practices in mind as much. So just as one example, when a person is doing the audit, right, a person, you know, one person can only audit a company so many times in a year, right? They've just got other things to do, and they can't be there 24/7.
Yeah.
But if you have software checking things, right, like the software does not get tired. It can just continue checking things, you know, every minute of every day for years on end. And it won't, you know, ask for a vacation or a raise. And I'm half joking, but kind of serious too. Like, I think we will just see more software verification of software and see kind of more of a move toward continuous monitoring and continuous verification here than in the past. Because now we can build software for checking these things in a way we just kind of couldn't or was much more difficult and much more bespoke 10, 20 years ago.
Absolutely. So that's a great segue into talking about how Vanta works. So from your site, basically you're using APIs to monitor the software stack that the company's using and to monitor that for security problems. So is this, to a certain degree, it's almost reminds me of a modern take on antivirus or anti-malware, not in the same vein directly, but where they were sitting there scanning your computer for malicious software. That basically, if I'm understanding this right, what Vanta is doing is using APIs to sort of monitor the applications in your stack and watch for data issues and potential audit problems from that data flow, basically. Is that generally correct?
Yeah. You got it at a high level. Basically, we're not looking for, I mean, it's hard to tell, you know, what does malicious mean? It's not like, oh, did someone install a malicious package in your, I don't know, AWS account or do you have malware in your email? And it's much more actually what we look for is misconfigurations. So did you, like Uber or like Capital One, you know, accidentally make one of your storage buckets in your cloud infrastructure account, like make one of the ways you store data just open to the world where anyone who had the URL could go to it and get, you know, all Uber driver data, right? And clearly that wasn't on purpose, or I think in that case, actually, it wasn't clear, but I don't think that was on purpose. That's just, these settings are hard and tricky, and there's a lot of them, and they interact in complicated ways. And, you know, Uber at the time had, you know, probably hundreds, if not thousands of engineers and thousands of storage buckets, right? Like these configurations are actually just really complex for any one person to reason about. And so these misconfigurations actually can be kind of common. And so that's the sort of stuff we're looking for. Does everyone at the company have two-factor authentication enabled on their email and on, you know, all their other key accounts? Is surprisingly uncommon, just because it's a little bit of friction to set up and people are moving fast and somebody's on vacation, you know, whatever it is, right? But once you get over that friction of having it set up, it just prevents a whole class of security breaches and attacks. Like, it is just so useful. And so it's just kind of misconfigurations like that.
Yeah, absolutely. I had put off doing two-factor authentication for the longest time. And a number of years back, I was in a Uber or something going somewhere, and I got several password reset emails all at the same time where someone was trying to hit, I believe, my iCloud and Facebook account at the same time. And it's like instantly, suddenly that bit of friction of doing a two-factor authentication versus the potential pain and loss of losing all your accounts. Suddenly, the friction didn't look like it was that bad anymore, and so I switched everything.
Yep.
But you need people to do it without actually having to have that kind of moment, right, of a scare coming in to make them want to do it.
Yeah, absolutely. In the very early days of Vanta, or what is now Vanta, we did some basically free consulting for other startups trying to figure out how we could, you know, build products that suited them. And one of the very early pieces of software we built, and even calling it a piece of software makes it sound larger than it is. But it was just something that would check they had two-factor on every email account with the company. And it was funny because we probably went to 10, 20 companies and I don't know, maybe half of them were like, oh yeah, two-factor's a mess. Like, give us a list of people and I'll try to track them down, but, you know, thank you so much. And half of them were like, oh, we do this. I mean, well, you know, we can check with you, but like, we're very on top of our, we, you know, care deeply over here at you know, Rocketship Inc. And so these 10 companies who said they were in good shape, 9 of them, of course, you know, did not have two-factor in everybody's account. and the best part was in, for like 5 of them, it was actually pretty good. It was like everyone but the co-founders, right? Or everyone but the office manager. And it was like everyone but the person who set up all the accounts. Right, who, like, you know, it's kind of one of those, like, the cobbler's children have no shoes thing, where they were very diligent about making sure everyone subsequently had it, but sort of had forgotten themselves in the mix. So I'll just say, my experience really is you are not alone in needing a bit of a push to enable it for yourself.
Right, yeah, I'm not surprised. It's one of those things, it's that, and using standard passwords on stuff. And then I wonder, is this something, I don't know if you've seen this as a problem in companies you work with, but where you have personal accounts slightly tied to business accounts. Mm-hmm. So maybe your personal email is the password reset email for a business account. And if that one's unsecure, then that's just this one link that can sort of knock down the whole house of cards.
Yeah, we do find that. And it's trickier, right? Because at a, again, at a under 10-person company, let's say, like, how many levels of redundancy do you really want to build in here? And so it is just this sort of, you know, cost benefit. You're trying to weigh these as best you can of what are the things you can do to make reasonable future-proof decisions, but also not, you know, burn a bunch of time sort of in process at the time. I think with the personal accounts in particular, there's just more of an awareness about those now than there was even, again, 4 or 5 years ago. I think we're just a little, everyone's just a little bit savvier of like, started a company, don't know what to call it, that's fine. Like, pay Gmail the $6 a month to get an email. It is only $6. Like, you can't afford it. Versus a few years ago where it felt silly.
Hello, Christine, are you there?
Hello. Yep, still there. Sorry, might have left
for
a moment.
Sorry, cut out for a second. Yeah, no worries. So there was a discussion in the Capiche community semi-recently about the number of SaaS products that the average company ends up using. And the answers were widely varied, but small companies were saying maybe a dozen or so apps. And there were companies, say, with 100 people that were mentioning using 100, 200 different SaaS products. And that explosion of using so much of a wide variety of software, has that made it more challenging to sort of keep track of all the data, mm-hmm. or are you still finding it's generally something where you can track via APIs and it's just rolling out integrations for each of these different products?
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot of integrations one way or the other. The thing we do just in a, building as fast as we can, but like everyone else who's, building startups, don't have infinite engineering capacity as much as we would like it.
Right.
But the trade-off we make and the trade-off kind of our customers make too is just differentiating like what data am I putting in this tool and how would I, worst case scenario, how would I feel about it if it were breached, right? And so if it's my bank account, how do I, that's different than customer information, than employee information. And folks tend to kind of make this hierarchy basically explicit or kind of unarticulated either way. And then just, prioritize based on that, right? So there's a set of vendors where you're like, look, I just really don't want to lose this stuff. And so we're gonna go all in on it. Versus the, this is one example, but the, flowchart diagram tool that is really useful. And in some ways we put, important company information, right? We put process innovation, we put roadmap information in, but like, look, if it turned out that all my flowcharts, were posted on Twitter tomorrow, I wouldn't be the most pleased, but I don't think that would be a company ending event. So sort of using that framework to prioritize.
And then very likely the vendors who have the most sensitive data, more or less, are most likely, I would presume, to be focused on security here as well. And so it's easier to track, say, your Stripe data versus, like you mentioned, the flowchart.
Yeah, exactly. And we sort of find this in, it's not as much who asks for a SOC 2 or who needs to get a SOC 2, because we sort of find that like everyone eventually needs to get a SOC 2, but how small are you when you get asked for one, right? And so if you are a banking tool where you integrate with a bank and you have people's financial data, you very well might get asked for a SOC 2 when you're two people on a couch. Those get asked for it super early. Versus if you're making the flowchart tool, you might, be able to grow to, tens or hundreds of employees before this truly becomes a business blocker for you. We just see this sort of, kind of risk prioritization segmentation happen across the industry where folks are doing it internally, and then it's also kind of being applied to them by their customers and prospects as well.
And then I believe if your product was used by a medical services company, a healthcare provider, that you would end up with, that would end up being HIPAA compliance, right? That would, how close, or is that entirely unrelated?
It's reasonably related. So HIPAA's, it's a really high level, HIPAA's a little different. So HIPAA actually is a U.S. government thing. It's not quite a standard, but it came in the early 90s, the first Clinton administration, and it's around the handling of sensitive healthcare information. And it actually came out of some brief history lesson, I suppose, but it came out of some mail, basically, where what can we mail, like what health information can we mail it to people? Who can see that letter and the envelope and what health information is kind of visible from that? Anyway, so
it's
been around. For kind of 20, 30 years, and based on physical paper mail, but it's sort of been adapted to the internet age and kind of EPHI, but electronic personal health information. HIPAA is interesting in that, really high level, you basically need to promised that you store electronic health and personal health information securely, and you will not leak it. And you can sort of promise that on your own. Like, you don't need to, you don't need to get an audit. You don't need to involve anyone else. But the sort of check of like, well, you know, why doesn't anyone, everyone just wake up in the morning and say, I'm HIPAA compliant, don't worry about me if it's that easy, is that once you've said you're HIPAA compliant, you, you conform to the HIPAA standard, then, and if you say you conform to the HIPAA standard and you have a data breach and you leak electronic health information, the fines are just sort of astronomical, just, you know, tens of thousands of dollars per affected person. And those are legally mandated. Like, this is the part that is a U.S. law. And so the check there is, you know, you get, you can sort of say you're HIPAA, you know, what, whenever you want to, but you are taking on this legal liability in doing so. And so that's the kind of people tend to like working with HIPAA auditors or consultants or folks to help them think through their data security practices, so they don't end up in a position where they're end up claiming something that, again, creates, you know, millions and millions and millions of dollars of legal liability later.
Right. Interesting. So that would potentially play into why a number of SaaS products, software products in general, have maybe a HIPAA version or something that's listed as maybe an enterprise, or you have to talk to sales to get this edition of the software. And it's almost because they're adding that guarantee on with the product.
Yeah, exactly. And there's this, you know, they're just trying to make kind of their risk calculus work, right? Because I'm not sure if your listeners who build software know, like, it's really hard to be 100% certain of lots of things and saying, you know, I'm 100% certain I'll never have a data breach. Well, it's kind of one of those things where if anyone says that, you should kind of ask them, like, what's going on? It's kind of a crazy thing to say. But kind of given we live in a world where there's some certainty around that, that, you know, you just can't chase down, like, there will be some risk there. You know, with the benefit to saying you're HIPAA acceptable, and so that's where, yeah, I think HIPAA things tend to be priced more, and that's just why you see that in the market, is because you're sort of paying the company to accept more risk on your behalf.
Right, that's fascinating. I know you've mentioned two-factor authentication. Do you have any other sort of, I guess, privacy and data security best practice you would recommend to the average member on a SaaS product, or any, honestly, for just someone in their personal life using SaaS software, of things that you see companies often mess up with from a security and privacy perspective that we could all be making better on an individual basis?
Yeah, for sure. I'll do a few personal ones and then a few for kind of engineering or technical kind of product development teams. For personal users, so two-factor authentication, I could not recommend more highly. Like, I know it takes a few minutes to set up, and then every 6 months you've got to find your phone. But it just prevents I don't actually mean to trivialize it. Like, I know it can be frustrating. And it's
right.
Like, do I have time for this? I'll do it next time. Like, click through the screen, right? Like, I totally get it. The flip side is just there's a whole kind of class or, like, whole type like someone trying to break into your account. That putting two-factor is kind of as close as possible that we have to avoiding those, right? Because it means that someone who wants to break into your account has to have your password and has to have your phone. And, like, it's possible, but it's way harder to have both of those things than it is to, you know, just get your password. As John Podesta taught us all in the 2016 election, like, they got his password and he didn't have two-factor. And so, you know, they got all of his emails and then promptly leaked them all over the internet. So, yeah, really take the time to put two-factor on your account, especially the ones you do not want to lose: email, bank, Bitcoin, Twitter, social media, whatever it is. Other personal things that tend to actually be, again, a little bit of friction, but then once you use it, you just will never go back, is use a password manager. Use something that generates, quote-unquote, strong passwords, but, like, long, complicated, you know, crazy letters and numbers passwords for you, and then stores them. And again, a little bit of friction, a little bit of change in the beginning. It's a little weird. You're going to put it in your phone, you know, and your laptop too. But just once you do that, you will literally never go back to being like, you know, my old password is my, you know, college dorm and my birthday and my mom's birthday. You know, you'll just, like, never go back. Like, which order did I put those in for this service, right? And you'll just, once you kind of start using a password manager, you'll look back on your former self trying to remember your mom's birthday and, you know, how it fit into your whatever Twitter password and wonder what you were doing. So really couldn't recommend that more highly. For engineering teams, two things that we've actually seen be quite impactful and much easier to implement early when the team is smaller versus later for cultural reasons. So two things here. One is code review. So just having a practice early on of like one engineer looks at another engineer's code before you push it. And this is more of a cult, and there's like a lot of kind of reasons to do code review. I know Microsoft has done studies here and has basically concluded that sort of the number one reason to do code review is for education and spreading knowledge on the engineering team, sort of buff factor, as it's called, is so, different folks know how different parts of the code base work. But from a security perspective, it's actually quite helpful because it means one person, whether they've been hacked or malicious or, you know, whatever, forgetful, just can't really introduce a vulnerability on their own. Like, you've got to have two people are looking at every piece of code that has changed. And turns out that's just really, really, really helpful. And it's really easy to do when the team is small and you're sort of bought into the idea. But when the team is much larger, it feels like a terrible process change and a bunch of overhead and it's going to slow everything down and like, ugh. So I'd recommend doing that as early as possible. The second part is engineering-wise, using one of the infrastructure as code tools, so like Terraform or CloudFormation, or I'm sure Azure has their version of it, GCP too, but something where basically you make infrastructure changes in code. And again, you just get the benefits of code review here. Like one person writes down the changes, someone else looks at them, you deploy it, you get your changes. Great. Versus sort of the, kind of old school way of doing things where it's like, oh, we need a new database. I'll just like open the web browser and click a button and we get a new database. And that's great. Yep. But kind of going back to our talk about access logs and logging things, it's really hard to log the like, oh, I just opened a web page and clicked a button and, now we have a new database. And you kind of want that audit log for, again, these big changes. But if you're using like a Terraform like tool, you get all that for free basically. So moving to one of those or starting to build with one of those is actually quite helpful from both a security and a compliance perspective.
Interesting. That reminds me of basically the problem of almost, I guess, orphan accounts you set up or databases you spin up and you use for something, and they just sort of sit there, and maybe they have some sort of data, but you forgot about it. And so then over time, that can be a potential security risk or privacy risk as you've got this sort of set of data sitting over there that may be old and whatever, but it still has value and importance, and it's not part of the main stack that you're maintaining and keeping up with.
Yeah, it's a very good point. It actually brings up something else. If you have customer data that you don't need, and it's kind of a very subjective definition, but like one way to think about that is like if you have customer data from people who have churned, who are no longer using your service, sort of think deeply about whether you need to keep that. And actually kind of be more open to deleting data, customer data. Like I think, I sort of grew up, quote unquote, in the like, again, early 2010s product development, right? When I would sort of collect all the data you can, because, you're going to be competing against Facebook and it's like a data game and it's an ad game and more data wins.
Yeah, the more the better.
Exactly. And I think now we're sort of shifting, one of like, look, Facebook or whoever just has so much, like, don't compete with them on this dimension, you will lose. But also a bit of, like, this stuff can be liabilities, right? And if you don't actually need to keep this thing, and it probably has non-zero, it has cost if it is leaked, right, or cost if something happens, do you actually need to keep it? And maybe you don't. And so, like, think through what, data deletion policies is, like, the enterprise-y way to say this, but just, sort of think through that because maybe you don't need to collect and save all the data that you've had historically.
Right. Yeah. It's a trend pretty much from everything from personal life to business life is you just you get anything comes in. Gmail even taught us don't delete emails. You just archive everything. And
Right. And
from one perspective, you end up just with a ton of digital junk, photos of receipts and nonsense that you really don't need to keep around. But then from a business perspective, as you mentioned, that can actually be a privacy and security risk as well.
Yeah.
Awesome. Thank you so much for sharing your tips and advice here. It's been fascinating hearing how everything, what you've learned about data security and how your team's built a product to help other teams ensure that they can keep their data secure. Thank you so much for sharing with us today.
Thank you so much for having me. This was very fun.
Awesome. And everyone who tuned in, thank you for listening. And we'll be back soon with the next episode of SaaS Radio Hour. Bye.
Thanks so much. Bye-bye.